poor boy Ross, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, y'all.
So for today, by the grace of God, fellowshipping with men, women, program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and because our program works and mine never did, I am a member of the Glen Haven Stone Mountain Group over in Stone Mountain. My sobriety date is December the 12th in 73. That may not impress some of you folks out there, but it just tickled the hell out of my kinfolk. I think it's only fair to tell you in the beginning, I'm just a little bit old-fashioned and I'm kind of countryfied. You never would have known that if I hadn't told you. I noticed they announced up here tonight we had about 10 different states. Some people here this evening. And I got thinking there might be some of these folks that knew me before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll tell you a little story. This was about an old buddy of mine that lived over in North Carolina. And he stole a man's milk cow. And they gave him 12 months in the chain gang. And when he finished his sentence, he was so ashamed of himself until he moved down in Georgia. And he got him a job and he went to work. And he started attending a little old Baptist church down the road. And he established such a good record in the community and in the church until after a while he was elected to serve on the deacon board. And after a while the preacher resigned and they asked this old buddy of mine if he would just fill in and be the preacher till they could get him one. And he accepted. And on the first Sunday morning, he walked up in the pulpit to deliver his sermon. He looked down the aisle, and he saw a long-legged joker come walking in that he used to be in the chain gang with. And he started his talk off something like this. Now, brothers and sisters, I came here this morning fully prepared to preach to you from the book of John. But after observing this great congregation, I have changed my text to the second chapter of Jude, where it says, if you knows anything or if you sees anything that ain't already leaked out, you just keep your big mouth shut till this meeting. I did quite a bit of research before I found out there ain't no second chapter of Jude, but it worked. Well, thank God we can laugh. I love to laugh, and I love to see other people laugh. I do believe it's some of the best medicine I've ever found in my life. Just a good old belly laugh. It'll help you digest them turnip greens, honey. But when I laugh, I have to remember that one day I cried. How about you? Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. My God, I cried on that pillow long enough. Don't have to cry no more. Don't have to be alone. That textbook I read said our stories disclose in a gentle way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I'll stick to that the way I remember it. I just love to talk about what it's like now. But in order to do that, I've got to touch on a few things that's not easy for me to talk about, and I'm sure it's not easy for you to talk about some of those things. I was born a little over 76 years ago over in Rockdale County. My old daddy was a sharecropper and a moonshiner. And I suppose by the time I was about 10 years old, I could operate a liquor still as good as my old daddy could. I knew all the ingredients that went into a batch of beer that would cause it to ferment when it was ready to be distilled. And that came in real handy in later years. I also remember that on this big plantation that we lived on, Everybody that lived on that plantation was a sharecropper and a moonshiner, or you didn't live on that man's farm. And up on the hill where the big man lived, around in the back, he had a little old commissary. And them poor white folks and them black folks would go up there to get a few supplies, and you didn't go to the front door, you went around and knocked on the back door. And I followed my old daddy up there many, many times, and I would watch him standing there with his hat in his hand and say, "Would you please let me have this, or would you please let me have that?" And I resented that. So I picked up on those resentments real early, and of course they got me into an awful lot of trouble. I remember in this old house that we lived in this old kitchen where we eat, there was always a jug of shine liquor set over in the corner, and in the other corner was a jug of sorghum syrup. So other than becoming an alcoholic, I turned out to be quite a syrup shopper, too. I am a living example. You can stay sober in this program and you don't have to mount to a damn thing. I don't know just how old I was when my old daddy moved us to Atlanta. And they moved us into a part of the city, and if you know about Atlanta, I'm sure you knew about this part, and they call it Cabbage Town. And then, as it is today, it was a real slummy era. And I think everybody that lived on the street we lived on was a produce peddler or a bootlegger. And every little boy that I began to associate with was a graduate from some reform school, or he was a candidate for some reform school. If he hadn't been, he was on his way. Now, we all know what it's like to be young at some time or another. And we like to be accepted by the people that we're so closely associated with. You are who you associate with. And I'm no different from anybody else. I wanted to be accepted. And I began to do the things these other young guys did. And I remember there'd come a time when some of these kids, Dad would buy them a bicycle. My dad was so poor, he couldn't buy me one, and I'd steal one. And a little later on, some of these kids, Dad would buy them an old hot rod, and my dad couldn't buy me one, and I'd steal one. So I always had just as much as the rest of the kids, but mine was all hot. They don't do this in Georgia today. There's a lot of difference today. This was back in March of 1929, and I was 16 years old. And they had me up in that Fulton County Courthouse. I found out that the law frowned on some of them things I was doing. And I never will forget what that judge told my mother. He said, "I'm going to send that boy of yours to the chain gang and let him see what it's like out there, and then I'm going to turn him right back out, and I'm sure your boy will be a better boy." And, of course, we would believe anything that anybody told us, especially the judge. And so I went off to the chain gang expecting to get out that night or no later than in the morning. That's what the judge said. But it didn't work that way. They kept me 4 years. And so here once again, of mixing and mingling with the people that I so closely associated with and wanted to be accepted, I had become a real smart aleck. I got another name for that, and I suppose you have too. I hated everything that stood for law and order, honesty, decency, and respectability. And that's what I was like 4 years later when I came back out on the streets of Atlanta and I drank liquor day and night. I couldn't tell you how old I was when I had my first drink of liquor. I was probably in diapers. My whole family drank liquor, and everybody we knew drank liquor, and we didn't see nothing wrong with drinking moonshine. Just a few days after being released from the chain gang in a drunken stupor on the outskirts of Atlanta, I wrecked an old automobile one night and I killed my mother. And I never got over that for a lot of years and a long, long ways down the road. And I could hear my mother crying and pleading and begging me to slow that car down, and I wouldn't do it. I was a smart aleck. And it was my fault, and I lost my mother. I've done an awful lot of inventory since I came to this fellowship, only that today I don't call it an inventory, I call it soul searching. And I well remember that there was a time when my mother wouldn't have 7 cents to ride that old street car with, and she'd walk in the rain or whatever down to this old Changang camp to bring me a sack of Bull Durham smoking tobacco and say, "Mama loves you, and we hope you can come home sometimes." But that was Mama, and I took it for granted, just like so many men, young men do today. You're my Mama. You're supposed to do all these things, I thought. And then, like so many mamas today, my mother, she upheld me in everything that I did. Her boy just couldn't do nothing wrong. And then I began to run with some of the worst people in this country. And a short time later, I was arrested and tried and convicted and sentenced to serve over 100 years. And so back to the Georgia chain gang I went, and my only hopes of ever being out again was to run out. And I run all my life. Run, rabbit, run. And I escaped, or I attempted to escape from every institution I was confined in except the last one. Most of those men that I was so closely associated with is not around today. Some of them were shot down and killed trying to escape. Some of them were shot down out on the streets of the highway by our policemen. Some of these folks went to the electric chair. So my friend, it's by God's amazing grace that I can stand here this evening and share a little of my experience, strength, and hope with you. Hoping that I might plant a little seed out there. I notice there's a lot of young people here. We are sowers, whether we realize it or not. I look back down through life. There's a lot of little seeds planted along the way. And after a while, these little seeds begin to sprout. And they begin to come towards the surface. Thank God one day they blossomed out in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. This was back in the days when they used the old sweat boxes and stocks. They'd hang you up in the old stocks by your ankles and your wrists. And I've hung in those stocks till the back of my hands were paralyzed for several years after these things were abolished in Georgia. And these old sweat boxes was made like a coffin, and it stood up on its end. And you would back up into it, and they'd close that door right against your face, and they'd bore a hole that'd breathe through. And you couldn't sit down, and you couldn't turn around. And I've stood in those old sweat boxes until my feet would swell up and bust my shoestrings. And they whipped me with everything imaginable, and I continued to get worse. Because you don't win people like that. Sometimes today people say, "Poor boy, how do you win them?" And I'm glad to tell you. There's a little four-letter word that says L-O-V-E, love. Thank God for this kind of love that I'm talking about this evening. This is why this is such a great fellowship. It is because of the love that you've seen here already this evening. The understanding and the identity. One drunk working with another drunk. There's not another fellowship like this in the world. The federal government built a place down yonder in Tatnall County that we call Reedsville, which is one of our state penitentiaries today. And I was one of the first convicts to enter that new prison in October 1937. And they locked me up in a little cell for 8 months until they could open up a rock quarry for incorrigibles. And I was transferred over there for the next 3 years, but I managed to escape on two different occasions. And they transferred me back to Reedsville under what they call a stop order, never to be transferred out again. And a short time later, we got a new warden down there, and out of 2,500 convicts, he picked 10 of us with the worst escape record. secure these men to maximum security. They'll never come back to population as long as I'm warden. We had a lot of friends and we had a lot of connections. And 30 days later, we escaped from maximum security. We came downstairs and we captured the whole inside of the penitentiary. This had never happened before and it's never happened since then. We're taking over the front office, the switchboard, and the powerhouse. And I walked down through those cell blocks with a market basket full of keys and I turned everybody out that said they wanted to run away. And so I let 100 out. We threw that main switch and we had a complete blackout. All the inside lights, outside lights, power lights all went out at one time. And 25 of us went out those front doors and taken cars off of the yard and escaped. And the other 75 I turned out went down and broke into the commissary and got all that juicy fruit chewing gum, brown mule chewing tobacco, hunkers and stamped envelopes. They didn't want to run away. They're just full of larceny and want to steal something. And within another 30 days' time, we were all back in jail somewhere. And they started what they called an eight ball squad. Our heads were shaven. Those old picks and chains welded around our legs. We were placed out in a stump digging detail. And every state trooper in the state of Georgia would have to come down there 10 at a time and say 10 days guard duty over this detail that they might know these men anywhere on site. We was not allowed any mail or any visitors, not even any lights in our cell. Life looked pretty hopeless in those days. So many of these men began to break their arms and to break their legs and to cut their heel tendons, the heel string. And some of them crippled themselves for life. And so eventually the word leaked out back to Atlanta. And the governor picked a group of men to come to Reedsville and make an investigation and try to stop this thing. He picked the president of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, a lot of judges, probation officers, newspaper reporters, and photographers. And one other man I'll never forget as long as I live. His name was Mr. Wiley Moore. And Mr. Moore was a millionaire banker in Atlanta. And the governor asked Mr. Moore to head up this group and said, the state of Georgia will back you men up 100% in any recommendations that you make. So they came to Reedsville and we were driven out of these old muddy river bottoms into this old dark cell house. And Mr. Moore said, open the door, I want to go in here and talk to these men. And they said, you can't go in there because it's too dangerous. And this was the first time in my life I ever heard anybody talk about God in a respectful manner. Mr. Moore talked about the God of his understanding and he said, I'm not afraid to go in there. And that got my attention. So he came in and we followed him to the rear of this old cell house and we sat down in a big circle. And Mr. Moore sat down in the center of this group with tears just flowing down his face and he brought us a message. He talked about this God that I didn't know about. He said, it's not for sale, you can't buy it. And the most amazing thing of all, he said, you don't have to be good to get it. It is a gift, you just accept it. I had all the respect in the world for that man because that man was for real and he was not afraid. But I could not, for the life of me, understand that kind of talk. I never forgot that message. He said, I'm going to take these old stripes and chains off of you. I'm going to let your hair grow out so you look like a human being. I'm going to let you pick any job in this institution that you can learn a trade that'll be worthwhile to you one day on the street. What an opportunity. He said, if any man in this detail would just do 5 years with a perfect record, I guarantee you a parole. There was only one man in that detail that taken advantage of that great opportunity, and as far as I know, he is the only one other than myself that's still living today. He's an old grandpa now. He never got back in trouble. But you know what kind of job I asked for? I asked for a job down in the steward's department. Now, that's where they got all that meal and sugar and syrup and
Yeast.
Well, I think we're fixing to identify here a little bit. You know, out here in the streets, now they call that stuff beer. But in the joint, I'm not talking about one of them funny cigarettes, they call it Buck. Now, Buck ain't nothing, just plain old still beer. That's all it is. And I learned all about that stuff from my old daddy, a little old barefooted boy working around a liquor still. And you know, your percentage of alcohol comes from the sweetening. And I could make that stuff so strong you'd need a chaser with it. And I can guarantee you that I drank alcoholically for many, many years in the penitentiary. For the next few years, there was a lot of things that happened. A lot of them were tragedies, and I don't talk about those. But there was a lot of humor along the way, and I like to look at the humor side of life. Now, most everybody had a nickname. They called me Po' Boy. And I had a little old buddy there, and if there's anybody in Reesville that loved that old Buck as good as I did, it was my old buddy there. And he had a nickname, and they called him Hitler. And I got up there one morning, I pulled off a batch of that old Buck. Hitler, he got... Now, old Hitler, he swore he didn't snitch on me. He didn't know how they found out. But then, as many other times, we'd have to go upstairs and eat bread and water for a few days, and that's the way I was doing time. But I used this little extra privilege I had of mixing and mingling with the other convicts, scheming, plotting, and planning. And after a while, I got me an old pistol smuggled in there. And I got up there one morning, and I was so drunk I didn't know I was in this world hardly. And I enticed five of these other men to help me, and we captured 19 of those free people. Had them all tied up in haywire, using them as hostages and trying to go through the back gate. I thought I wanted out bad, but I can honestly tell you people this evening, thank God I didn't get through those gates that morning. I wouldn't have been living today. And anything that I tell you that happened to me, don't you feel sorry for Po' Boy. I ask for every bit of it. I was in this fellowship for a long time before I realized and accepted the fact that I am responsible for my actions. Those people didn't do it to me, I did it to me. And so they stripped me off naked, and I was beaten till I was blooded a hog, and I went to the death house. And there I remained for the next 2.5 years, right in the shadow of the Georgia electric chair. This did not make a Christian out of me, but it certainly did change my attitude about a lot of things. Because I had a ringside seat. 2.5 years later, I came back to population, and I had a thought like this. When I go again, I'll go out that front door a free man. Or I'll go out that back gate in a pine box. I give up. I can't beat you. And in my way of thinking, for the next 7 years, I made what I called a good record. Now, I stayed drunk most of the time. But I stopped trying to escape. And that was a record for me, and people in Georgia began to notice. Back in the old days, all they had was a prison commission. And it consisted of 3 men, and they were the whole works in the prison system in Georgia. By this time, we had a pardon and a parole board. Mr. Ed Everett was chairman of the board. And every year he would come down there and set up a tape recorder and make a recording of my attitude and get back up to the Capitol and play it. And I know that my attitude was stinking to high heaven. But after 7 years, Mr. Everett said, Po' Boy, we feel like you might have been in long enough, but you've been too closely confined for too many years to be turned out with the public. I didn't know anything about World War II. I had no trade. All I knew how to do was dig up a stump out there in the field or dig a ditch. He said, we're going to recommend that they send you back out to a road camp and let you mix and mingle with the people out there and get used to being around folks, and then we'll give you a parole. So they sent me up down to Cobb County. on trial, and they told my people that if he'll stay up there 1 year and do good, we're going to give him a parole. I felt like a misdemeanor. I counted months off, the weeks, the days, and that year was up. Just about bugged everybody out there. I'd get up that morning hollering, "Short time, short time." When that year was up, they sent me a big old long envelope and said, "Stay another year." I couldn't understand that. You know, I come to find out later on they did this for psychological reasons, just to see if I could stand a little disappointment, because you know we do run into them occasionally. And I was a real weak individual. And those old resentments set in, and that old attitude, I'll show you. And I said, when my folks come to see me Sunday, I'm going to get what money they got, and I'm going to leave, because I could have lived real easy then. But all these years I'd been gone, my little old brother and sister growed up and had families of their own, and they had all become church people. And I never could understand why they didn't talk to me about God. I guess they thought I was just a hopeless case. And I remember they came out there that morning, and I was so bitter at the state of Georgia, and I wanted them to feel the same way I did, and they just dropped their head and began to cry. And I didn't know how to fight anything like that. My sister said to me, "I know you don't have a God, but I do." She said, "There's a lot of people praying for you. Please don't louse this thing up. Let me go back down to the chapel." And I owed her an awful lot. She had run her legs off for many, many years trying to help me. But then, just like my mother, I took her for granted. "You are my sister. You're supposed to do all this," I thought. The very next day when I came in, they said, "Poor boy, you stay in tomorrow. There'll be somebody going to get you and carry you up to the chapel. They want to talk to you some more." I couldn't hardly sleep on that old bunk that night for thinking about a God somewhere that Mr. Moore talked about, my sister talked about. Sure enough, the next day they carried me to the Capitol, and there's a lot of people up there representing me. I didn't know them. They're just friends of my family. And they said, "We're going to reconsider, and we'll let you know what our final decision is in about 10 days or 2 weeks." And so a couple of weeks later, they paroled me, and I'd been in 20 years, 1 month, and 2 weeks. And when you made parole back in those days, they didn't give you anything. Somebody would have to come pick you up, carry you home, and bring you some clothes to wear. And I never will forget, my sister brought me a pair of slacks and a sports shirt. And that was the first time in my life I'd ever owned a pair of breeches with a zipper on them. And I'm telling you, that really turned me on. I'd catch myself standing in front of the mirror going, "Zip, zip, zip, zip." And that's what I was like. I went home to live with my sister. And every time the doors of the church was open, my people all went to church. And it was sort of a take it or leave it proposition. Now, you can go with us, or you can stay here by yourself. And so out of curiosity, I went to church. I went for all the wrong reasons. I met a lot of wonderful people, people who wanted to help me. But a person who had lived like I had so long, I kept everybody at a distance, and you couldn't get close to me. And I refused that help. But there was one good thing that came out of me going to church, and I'm sure there's some people here this evening that knew this little lady. Her name was Flo. And that's where I met Flo at. And a short time later, Flo and I, we got married. We rented some furnished rooms. 2 men in that church got me a job digging ditches for a plumbing company. I'm a good ditch digger. I went to digging ditches, and me and Flo would go to church on Sunday. And during this time, I didn't drink liquor. And after a while, they gave me a dime raise and made me a plumber's helper. And I stayed with that until I got one of those little old cards that said that I was a journeyman plumber. I said, now I can make some money. So I went out to Emory University. And I got me a job out there as plumbing. I could just about wear my house shoes to work. I worked out there 2 years, and I didn't drink liquor. And one morning they called me in the office and said, "I hate to tell you this, poor boy, but this is a big thing in DeKalb County. A lot of folks know this poor boy, and your past is caught up with you. And we can't work you out here. We're going to have to let you go. Once again, that old attitude came back. I'll show you. I'll get even. And that old pride wouldn't let me go home and tell Flo what had happened. She was a much stronger person than I was. She would have understood, and we could have worked it out. But I was mad. I was full of anger and resentment. Every morning I'd let her put that bread and meat in the sack, and I'd leave like I was going to work, and I didn't have a job. And I didn't want a job. I was mad. And I didn't know anything about legalized liquor or beer. And I walked in one of those honky-tonks, and I called myself getting even. I began to drink that stuff. And after a while, I'd be in such a shape till I didn't want Flo to see me like that, and I wouldn't go home. And I'd walk the streets of Atlanta all night by myself, feel sorry for poor boy, and drink liquor. And after a while, I couldn't go home because the police was watching the house. I was doing some things I ought not have been doing. And I knew I was going to have to run again. And I wanted to see Flo just one more time before I run. Excuse me. So I got my brother to go pick Flo up. We went out down where South 75 is now, a little old motel. And we spent the night out there. And the next morning I walked up to the bus stop with Flo, and I watched her get on that bus going home. And Lord, I wanted to go home with Flo so bad I didn't know what to do. And I remember standing there and questioning myself that morning, as I have so many times, and I'm sure you have too. Why? Why? Why am I this kind of person? Why can't I be like other people? I could come up with 900 excuses, but deep down in my heart, I couldn't find an answer. Thank God I got an answer today in this fellowship. I'm an alcoholic. And I run. I went to another state. The trouble was, I carried the problem with me, and that was poor boy, and that's where it's been all the time. And that liquor in them other states is just exactly like it is in Georgia. And I went into DT's. And the police picked me up, shipped me back over to Atlanta, and they put me under a $10,000 bond. And my sister put up a home, everything in the world she had, to get me back out on streets, to walk the streets at night and drink liquor and feel sorry for poor boys. I run again this time. I went to another state. Put in jail the first night I got there. And walking up this main street about 2 o'clock in the morning, drunk and crazy. Couldn't find nobody that would talk to me. Couldn't find no liquor. Reckon I saw those neon lights flashing down there. Fancy wine and liquor. And I said, oh, here's one. Well, it was, but they'd closed too. And I could stand there on that sidewalk and look at those shelves. They came right up to that big plate glass window. And there was half a pints and filths and quarts. And what does a crazy alcoholic do? I haul off and hit that glass with my hand, and it just broke and fell out all over me in the sidewalk. And I split my hand open. I didn't even have sense enough to know I was cut. And just filled my pocket full of them bottles and walked up the street. And I didn't get very far till the police run up there and throw a shotgun on me and carried me back down there. And I had blood all in my pocket and all over my clothes and all over them liquor bottles and on the sidewalk and them other liquor bottles. And I lied like a dog. I said, I didn't do that. They said, how in the world are you going to deny something like this? I said, I don't know, but I am, and I did. And the next morning, there was a city detective that was trying to question me, and I was about to go into convulsions. And he didn't want me to die on his hands, so he said, I'm going to do something for you. He went back there, and he got me a glass about that high, full of liquor. He said, don't you tell them other folks I give you this. Boy, that was a good drink of liquor. It probably saved my life. They kept me in jail 5 weeks, and the grand jury met and failed to indict me. They called me downstairs one evening, about dark in the wintertime. Said, the grand jury didn't indict you, and they opened the door and said, get, and I got. And I run 5 blocks. I thought they'd made a mistake. And after a while, I said, now, them people ain't all that crazy. They had a reason to turn me out. And I didn't know for a good many years later, and I was in a big meeting up in Maryville, Tennessee. And I was talking to a judge up there from this city. We got to talking about that, and he got to laughing. He said, poor boy, said, I came into this program about 31 years ago and went to work on a garbage truck. Then he said, I got on with the fire department. And then I became a policeman. He said, now I'm judge. He said, that old boy that gave you that drink of liquor was one of us. He was a member of this fellowship, and he knew a whole lot more about you than you did yourself. He said, he is the man that went before the grand jury and said, this man is an alcoholic. And if you just turn him loose, he'll go back to Georgia, and we won't have food with that idiot. Takes one to know one, don't it? And you know, that's exactly what I did. I made my way back to Flo to get what money she had, walked the streets at night, drank liquor, and feared sorry for four. And about this time, an old buddy of mine got out of the penitentiary. We'd run together for nearly 50 years. Him and I was going up that four-lane highway right near Marietta one evening, about dark. Both of us drunk, old beat-up Ford. And we had a flat tire. We didn't have a spare. Right across the road was a filling station. So we went over and bought a new tire, and the man said, pull your car over here in the yard, and I'll put it on for you. So here's two drunks trying to get that old Ford across that expressway. And there was a Thunderbird dealer, and his family from up in Ohio was on the way to Florida on vacation, and they run over us and tore up our car. And we jumped out and took theirs away from them. You know, that just, right at that particular time, that just looked like the normal thing to do. Man, you done tore up my car, now you give me that and you got it. But I come to find out the law frowns on that too. So it wasn't so much as what really happened, but because of our past, see. And they tried me and this old boy, and they gave us 20 more years apiece and sent us both back to Reedsville. I couldn't see no way in the world live 20 more years in there. If I'd have had the nerve, I'd have cut my throat. And I didn't know how to pray. Thank God Flo knowed how to pray, and I'm sure a lot of other people prayed. And I like to look at it this way, because God answered somebody's prayer about 14 months later, and it was far different from anything that I could imagine. It's building a new prison camp there in Stone Mountain Park. And they transferred me up there to put the plumbing in that new prison camp. We finished that new prison. The warden had us to install a little chapel out in one end of the mess hall. And he called me out on the front and he said, poor boy, I have a different assignment for you every Sunday afternoon. We're going to have a different church group from all over this area to be coming out here holding service. Said, I want you to stand by the door and welcome the people when they come in here. I'm going to get some song books, and I want you to lead the singing. He said, I want you to go back there in those bullpens and form a choir out of those convicts. Now, if you think that was dumb, I'll tell you something dumb than that. I wanted to do it. You know, our program tells us half measures avail us nothing. I've been believing that a long time. I never did believe in straddling the fence. So I wanted to do what he asked me to do, but I knew I wasn't in no shape to do that. And I didn't know how to pray, but I'd seen a lot of praying down in the death house. And I found me an altar, and there was an old black burnt hickory stump out in the woods. And I'll never forget it as long as I live when I dropped down on my knees by that old stump and I said, God, if there is a God, whoever you are and wherever you at, I give what's left of old poor boy to you. I ain't going to run no more. Lord, I'm so tired. I'm so tired of that old ugly, dark, and negative side of life. And something happened. And I don't have the vocabulary, and I could stand here and talk all night and I couldn't put it into words.
folks have heard some of my singing.
He was a kind of a cross between George Beverly Shea and Piano Red. But you know, I enjoyed doing it. And the warden let me go out in the front yard with a bulldozer, and I built a baptizing pool and run hot and cold water. We turned it on. You know, I did that for the next 5 years. Flo could come out there on Sunday evening setting those services. And I still had that numb on the seat of my britches, but I felt sort of like I was free. Something had happened. I look at it this way. This God I talk about don't have to be in a great big hurry about anything. He's always right on time. 5 years later, one morning I said, "Poor boy, I just saw Flo go around the corner up there with his Sunday britches. And it like scared me to death. I thought some of my kin folks had died. Maybe they'd got a court order and I was going to a funeral." But that wasn't the case. Miss Rebecca Garrett was still living in. She was chairman of the pardon and parole board. Maybe she still had a little faith in me. Somewhere between 6 and 7 years there, she had decided to parole me again. And Flo would come to carry me home. And we didn't know hardly how to talk to each other that morning when we went home, but we knew where our help come from. We couldn't hire a lawyer. We didn't have a dollar and a half between us. I went back to work at plumbing work for the next 3 years, and I didn't drink liquor. Then I got involved with a gospel singing group and stayed real busy for about 3 years, and I didn't drink liquor. And then I took a job as maintenance man at a big motel. And the liquor and the beer flowed real freely there with all the conventions they were having, Shell Oil Company and Standard Oil Company. 6 years on the outside, I hadn't had a drink. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. And one day, I decided I'd drink one of those good old cold Budweisers like these other boys are doing. I can take it or I can leave it. I haven't drank one in 6 years. My friends, when you read in that textbook that this is a progressive illness and it always gets worse and it never gets better, please believe it. How do you know, poor boy, from personal experience, which is the best teacher I've ever found in my life? Now, I didn't get drunk that day or that night, but I did get drunk. Down drunk. Scared to death. Nobody knew what to do with me. Somebody told Flo, said, "Put him over in Peachtree Parkwood." So she put me in Peachtree Parkwood, and I went in that drunk and I come out drunk. They had a little deal going over there then. They thought they could taper you all. And for the first 3 days and nights that you was in there, every 2 hours, you could go up to the nurse's stand and they'd give you 2 ounces of alcohol and some fruit juice. And you better believe every 2 hours around the clock, I was standing there waiting on my medicine. So I was still drunk and crazy when I came out of there, and we'd spent all the money we'd saved up, and the insurance was all gone. And from then on, I made the rounds, GMHI, Georgian Regional, all these places. And I was in and out of those places so fast, it's a wonder I hadn't died from exhaustion before I ever got to Alcoholics Anonymous. The last alcoholic hospital I was in was over at GMHI. And I suppose it would have been the same old merry-go-round with exceptions of one thing. On Monday night, they had an AA meeting out there. And so they announced on the loudspeaker, "We got an AA meeting out in the lobby if anybody wants to go." And so once again, out of curiosity, I went out there to see what an AA meeting is. And there were some people from the Rockdale County group was holding a meeting out there. And there's a very dear lady friend that was in that meeting. Some of y'all may know it, runs a rehab place up there in Conyers now. She said I looked more like a dead man than anybody she'd ever seen. And she came over to me after that meeting and said, "Poor boy, do you want to get sober and stay sober?" And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I sure God do, but I can't do it. I just can't find no way to do it." She said, "I'm not going to try to tell you how to do it, but I'll be glad to tell you how I did it." Now, that got my attention. Somebody's going to share with me how they did something. She gave me her telephone number, and that was the most important phone call ever made in my life. Because that morning when I left that hospital, I called Sue. And she got the little meeting book out and looked up the closest meeting where I was living at in Stone Mountain, which is my home group today. She said, they got a meeting over there tonight. Now you get yourself over there. And I went very suspicious, very doubtful, very skeptical. I didn't think anything would work. And I remember it was a discussion meeting. And every time they'd call on one of those men or women, they would say, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. And I thought, my God, if that's what an alcoholic is, what in the world am I? Because to get from where I was to where it looked like those people was would have been a high step up for me. I was a knee-walking drunk. And I decided that night, you know, if I can just find out what these people are doing, maybe I can be an alcoholic like them. I didn't want to be Po' Boy Rice. I wanted to be anything except Po' Boy Rice. I didn't like me. I hurt, and I was sick. I asked a lot of questions in that meeting that night, and I got some answers. One of the questions was, hey, what do I have to do to be like you folks? Now, they knowed I was a fool, and so they kept it real simple, and they said, don't drink and go to meeting. You see, if they'd have told me any more than that, I wouldn't know what in the world they was talking about. And so I didn't drink, and I went to meeting. And after a while, I got to where I could eat, and I got the wrinkles out of my belly, and that felt good. I could lay down at night and go to sleep, and that felt good. I could get up in the morning, put my britches on, go to work, and make a little money. And I'd go to those meetings and buck dance around and tell dirty jokes, don't drink, go to meetings. I'm the only man in my home group to ever give a birthday party in 6 months. Nobody thought that I could stay sober a year. Now, they had a big old fat boy in my home group there, and I just hated him. Because every time he'd open his mouth, he'd say, the big book said, and the big book said, and I didn't want to hear what the big book said. I wanted somebody to pat me on the shoulder and say, Po' Boy, you sure are doing a good job. I just hated him. The night I had 6 months in and picked up my 6 months chip, his little old wife brought me a cake, and on that cake it said, Po' Boy, 6 months. The group conscious had voted that you had to have 6 months sobriety to be secretary, and this happened to be the night they were going to elect him a secretary. Now, you know how them little old AA elections go. Somebody said, I nominate Po' Boy. Somebody said, I second the motion. Somebody said, I move the nomination be closed. Second that. You're it. And I said, what is it? What am I? He said, you're our secretary. And I thought I owned my own group then. Don't drink, go to meeting. Be secretary. But you know, I'd go over and I'd set that meeting up and I'd make the coffee and I'd put them chairs where I wanted them and people would come in and I'd tell them where they could sit and where they couldn't sit and all that stuff. You know. But I didn't drink. I didn't drink. It was good for me. And I went on and I celebrated a sure enough birthday. But then 6 more months was up, see, and I lost that high office job as secretary and had to come down and be just a regular AA member. And about 6 months later, those meetings started getting a little bit dull. Kind of boring. Don't drink, go to meeting. And that come as near getting me drunk as anything that happened since I got to this fellowship. And I caught myself sitting in the parking lot of a packing store, and I really didn't want to get drunk, but I knew I was about to. And I couldn't understand that. And I remembered right in the nick of time something an old fellow shared with me, and he said he was in a similar situation. and said he prayed and asked God to help him. And I remembered that. And I bowed over that steering wheel and I said, God, please help me. I can't help myself. And I drove that car out of that parking lot. And then when I got into the big book and I found my answer, it says there will come a time when we'll have no effective mental defense against that first drink. I had no mental defense against it, but when I called on that power, it was bigger than me and that bottle to help came. And that's as close as I've come to drinking since I came to this fellowship. But I knew if I got drunk, I'd die. I'd never get back. And I had argued about sponsorship. And I had argued about an inventory. You name it, I'd argued about it. And I decided if I'm going to stay sober and get what this program has to offer, I was going to have to get me a sponsor and somebody show me how to work this program. And guess who I asked to be my sponsor? The fat boy. Now, I knew that old boy would tell me the truth, and he didn't care whether I liked it or not. And I went to him, and I said, would you consider being my sponsor? And he said, oh, boy, I've already seen you celebrate a birthday now. What makes you think you need a sponsor? And then I said, like I've heard so many other people say, well, my program ain't working too good right now. Now, he had a big old fat boy, and when he laughed, he didn't open his mouth. His old belly just jumped up. And I saw his old belly jump. He said, oh, yes, hell it is. Your program's working real good. It was your program that got you to our program, and our program's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'm going to be your sponsor, the first thing we're going to have to do is get rid of your little old program before you get drunk, him. I could have killed him. I didn't kill him. You know, thank God we still got some folks around this program to tell us the truth, ain't we? Thank God for him. He told me the truth. He said, what do you think about that inventory? I said, I don't know how to do that. He said, I know it. Will you start on one if I'll show you what to look for in that big book? And I said, yeah. He knew how to keep the props cut out from under a rationalizing alcoholic. Yeah, yeah. He showed me what to look for. And I worked on my inventory. And way after a while, I called him one morning and I said, I have finished my inventory. Now I want to do that fifth step right quick. He said, run that by me again now. I said, well, I done finished the thing, man. He said, you got a 12 and 12? I said, yeah. He said, turn to page 50 and read it. And I read it, and it said, a four-step inventory is but the beginning of a lifetime practice. He said, you through yet? No. Well, have you went as far as you know how to go right now? And I said, yeah. He said, well, bring your inventory and come on over here. Yeah. Me and my little wife went over, and his wife and my wife stayed upstairs. He had the big book, and I had my inventory, and we went to the basement and locked the door. Now, we talk about having something called a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Now, down there in the basement with my sponsor that morning, I had something I call a spiritual conniption fit. Picture in your mind, if you can, here's two great big old ugly men, and we stood up and embraced. And I hugged my sponsor's neck, and he hugged my neck. And it was the first time in my life I ever told another man that I loved him. And he told me, he said, I love you, poor boy, for what you're trying to do. And then when we get into these trying to make amends for the harm we've done, I didn't know it then, but I know it today. Had I not had his guidance, I could have really loused up some things. I got one brother that's living, and I love my brother. But I'll guarantee you I love my sponsor just as good as I love my brother. Because my sponsor knows a whole lot more about me than my brother does. There's been a lot of things that happened to me since I became willing, with God's help, to try to live this program. I guess one of the most major good things that happened to me was several years ago. I received something that don't many people ever get unless they can prove their innocence, and I couldn't do that. But I received a full unconditional pardon from the state of Georgia after being on the streets for 13 years. First time I'd been free since I was a little boy, and I just broke down and cried tears of gratitude. I come to find out from experience, just because we don't drink liquor, everything's not going to go real good all the time. Some things are going to happen along the way. They always have, and they always will. In June of 1985, me and Flo had just came out of a conference and got home Sunday afternoon. And I supposed to have been in Jackson, Mississippi the next weekend. And on Tuesday morning, Flo and I was on our way to an AA meeting, and Flo had a stroke. And I put her in the hospital, and they put her on one of those life support machines. And they kept her alive for 15 days, but then I lost Flo. And it just seemed like my whole world fell out from under me. I'd go home at night, about a week later, and all my AA friends had done gone, and I'd start feeling that anger. I start feeling that self-pity. All those negative emotions begin to creep back in. But I had learned in this program what to do. I didn't have to drink liquor. And then in August, I suppose, I'd been in the Southeastern Conference in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'd already made the commitment, and I didn't want to go. I just didn't think I could go. Joe Phelan don't care if I break his anonymity. Joe called me and said, "Poor boy, you've got to go. Don't you worry about it, you just go." But I could just picture in my mind, every time, you know, that Flo and I'd be in a conference somewhere and it would come my time to go to the podium, and Flo would say, "Which one of those old suits are you going to wear tonight?" And I had two. I'd say, "I'll wear that old brown." And Flo had an old brown sack slack suit. She wanted to dress just like poor boy, and she put on that old brown slack suit. And she'd always sit right down on the front row. And sometimes I'd get weak and my knees would get wobbly and I think I couldn't go ahead. And I could look down that floor and them big brown eyes would be right on me. She believed I could do it. And that would give me that little extra lift that I needed to go on. I didn't want to go, but I went. A lot of good Georgian folks was up there supporting me. And I think it helped me. Anytime I'm in a meeting, whether it's a great big meeting or just a small meeting, my heart and my mind is always centered on that new man and new gal that's just coming through them doors. God help us that we don't ever forget these new people. Let's remember that one time we were new too, and we know how scared and how suspicious and skeptical we were. And so in closing, I want to share something with you. And it's simply this, and it's based on personal experience, which is the best teacher I've ever found in my life. The problem that you may have today, or the problem that may be a little further down the road, it is never greater than this source of power that old poor boy stood up here and tried to share with you this evening. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to come down here, and thank you for being here, and God bless every one of you.